Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Golden Hour with your host, Allie Goldberg. Today, I have a really special guest today. I have Sergeant Lowe with us. Do you want to say hi?
Hello, hello.
So he is a police officer, and he's a part of the San Diego Police Department. So do you just want to give a quick little rundown of like who you are, what you do, all of that jazz?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm Jonathan Lowe. I'm with the San Diego Police Department. I've been with San Diego PD for over 20 years now. 18 and a half years I did in the field. So I worked 4 different patrol stations, moved around the city a little bit, had some time doing specialized units like the SWAT team, being a training officer, teaching at the academy. And currently I'm in the recruiting unit. So for the last 2 years, my job has been to bang the drum and let people know that the San Diego Police Department's hiring and all the benefits of being a police officer.
Wow. So that's pretty impressive that you've been in the field for so long and you've done so many things. How did you get to be where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, originally when I was younger, I thought about being a veterinarian. You know, I grew up in San Diego. I had the zoo. I had SeaWorld in my backyard, and I loved animals, and I still do. But I was terrible at chemistry. science and math and all that wasn't my strongest point. But no, honestly, I applied to colleges to be for pre-veterinary schooling. But my senior year, I participated in a high school camp that was diversity focused. It really talked a lot about racism and sexism, religious bias, homophobia, and cops and youth relations was part of that. And I ended up meeting a police officer, and after the camp, we kept in contact, and he actually took me on a ride along down in southeastern San Diego. That was the division he worked. And it changed my mind right away. I was just like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Like, this is so crazy. Like, I always thought being a police officer, you know, my image of that was just somebody who, you know, never went to college or got out of the military, and, you know, they wanted to do the same stuff over and over again. But that officer really showed me the career aspects of law enforcement. And it's not just about the person, you know, driving the black and white police car, although that's our backbone, right, of being a police officer. But that's not all there is to law enforcement. And he really showed me those career aspects and really got me hooked.
I find that all you need is one person to just show you what it really is like. So in terms of training, how long did that take? What is that like? Are you scarred from it?
No, you know, the actual police academy is 6 months long. You know, it's a paramilitaristic environment, which means, you know, there is a rank and file structure. And to somebody with no military experience like myself, you know, to me, it felt like boot camp. To a real, like, Marine who've been to Marine boot camp, you know, that's nothing. But, you know, I'd never gotten yelled at before. I never had to do push-ups, you know, all day, every day. But, you know, it's fun. To be honest, I got paid to work out and to learn and to go to school. You know, essentially, you're paid to be in the police academy. Okay. You know, you're an employee with full benefits. So if you look at it that way, it's not that bad. But, 6 months of actual formal training in the academy. And then when you get done, you come out to the field and you do 4 months of training with another officer. So another trainer is riding with you in the police car to help you translate what you learned in the academy to, okay, this is real life. There's no reset buttons. There's no do-overs. So whatever happens, happens. And so that's the training officer's responsibility to make sure that everybody's safe and, you know, the new officer is doing the right thing. And if they have to step in and take over, then that's what they're there for.
So with this training, did you ever shoot a gun before training?
I never shot a gun before.
How was that like?
Scary. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I grew up in San Diego, so I didn't like hunt or do anything, you know, outdoorsy like that. And my first time shooting a gun was in the police academy. But, you know, when you're in the academy, everything that you do is, you know, building blocks, right? Step by step. So starting with classroom, just nomenclature, how to take a gun apart, you know, the moving parts, everything like that, talking about it, and then going out to the range and just starting with baby steps of, you know, just static shooting. And then you progress your way up to shooting on the move and moving further back and shooting from a police car and all the different positions, shooting with your left hand or, you know, your offhand. So, no, everything in the police academy is, you know, building block formation.
Right. So I have shot a gun before, and I thought it was so scary because – so my brother was in town. He's a little older than me, and we wanted to do some sibling bonding. And he was like, let's go shoot a gun. I was like, can we just get our nails done or something?
Funny way to bond. All right.
I was like, okay, I don't know about this. And I went, and I thought it was so crazy just because, like, you don't realize the force in the your shoulder jerks back. The bullets are – or not – I didn't get shot by a bullet. The casing.
Right.
And they're hot, and – I could not do that. It must be a learning experience when people are moving and like stuff like that. Was that the hardest part, you think?
You know, the whole thing is just a mental game, to be honest. You know, you really, you're learning so many different things, whether it's shooting, driving, the way that we drive, our pursuit driving, defensive tactics, when you're learning how to handcuff people and how to search them. I mean, there's just so many things you have to be good at and proficient at before you can pass. And then again, it's a matter of, can you translate that to, okay, this is real life. Now we're responding to a real call. We're going to talk to a real victim or a real suspect. And, you know, are you going to search them properly? Are you going to find a pocket knife, a dime bag of coke? Once it's real life, that's when it's really scary.
Right. I've always actually wondered, I'm sorry, I'm so interested about this training because I will never go through it for many reasons. I mean, I can't see well, and there's a lot of things that are going against me, but that driving, how do you get past that? Because I feel like, don't you want to just stop at red lights? It must be scary to drive. Have you ever been in an accident?
Me personally, I've only been in two accidents on duty, and they've been relatively slow speed, to be honest. When we're driving with our lights and sirens, that is such high risk that we know that, you know, going into it, and we practice over and over. And actually every 18 months or so, we have to go to a refresher training. It includes all your perishable skills like shooting, driving, CPR, first aid, those sort of things. And, you know, anytime we're going, it's called code 3, right? When we're doing lights and sirens, if we're going to a call, like we know that the most important thing is to get there, right? Yes, we want to get there quickly because we want to help people or whatever the urgency of the situation is. But if we never show up in the first place because we crashed or did something crazy, then it doesn't help anybody. Probably the scarier part is when you're actually pursuing somebody, right? You're in a vehicle pursuit because the person's not stopping. You know, there's a chance that you know why they're not stopping because maybe it's a bank robber that you're chasing after. But I've had pursuits where I just tried to pull you over because you didn't have your headlights on in the middle of the night. And the person kept going and kept going. And I went from, in one particular case, I chased somebody from Claremont all the way down to Chula Vista.
Oh, my God.
Simply because they didn't have their headlights on. And in my head, I'm like, why is this person not stopping? Are they wanted? Do they have a gun? And it just turns out that the person wasn't from this country, didn't speak English, didn't really realize what they were supposed to do when the police were behind them, and made this kind of big old production. But that's the thing. You just never really know what you're getting into. But the most important thing for us is our officer safety. Like I said, you have to drive with due regard for the public. We have to make sure that we're providing a police service, but doing it in a safe manner so that nobody gets hurt.
I feel like you always have to proceed with caution because, I mean, with that big pursuit chase that you were just talking about, it could be someone who is totally innocent. They just genuinely didn't know.
Exactly.
And then, or you could be dealing with like something way bigger and you just, there's such an in-between. There's such a gray area. It's very interesting. So do you have any cons of being on the job?
Cons of being on the job? I saw the question that she wrote for me and I really can't think of actual cons of the job. Because our job is so much fun. I mean, there's so much that you can do, like I said, within this career. There's so many different paths that you can take. You know, the only negatives, I guess, that I've seen over time is if it has to do with your health, right? Whether that's your physical health or your mental well-being. This job is very stressful, obviously. There's a lot of pressure on the officers that are out there to do the right thing. We're always in the public spotlight. The news media is not always the friendliest to us, and so there's a lot of pressure to perform to that standard. And then there's just the physical tolls that shift work takes on you, your diet, your exercise, or lack thereof, right? And, you know, also officers who don't surround themselves with people who aren't in law enforcement. You know, that's very important. When we talk to our new folks that are coming out of the academy, I tell everybody to keep your friends that you have now, you know, before you started the police academy. You're going to bond with so many new people. You're going to have this new family within law enforcement that sometimes that takes over your whole life. That this is your whole world is being a cop, and, you know, this is your bubble, and you start to kind of lose touch with your non-cop friends. And when that happens, you start to get less grounded. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I make a really great effort to keep in touch with my friends that are not law enforcement because, like I said, they keep me grounded. It doesn't, you know, it reminds me that not everybody's a bad person, right? Because most of our job is responding to calls where people did something to somebody else, right? Responding to the worst of humanity sometimes, right? And so if that's what you see all day, every day, then your idea of humanity kind of dips into the negative scale, right? Yeah. But if you have friends, you have family that are not in law enforcement, and you keep those relationships, or you have faith, or, you know, you work out and go to the gym, or, you know, relieve your stress in some manner, then you remind yourself that the world is mostly good people. It's just that your job is to deal with the ones that are not being good most of the time, right?
Yeah, I never thought of that, really, because, I mean, I'm usually surrounded by really good people.
Right.
And I never put myself in a cop's shoes and realized that that's all you deal with is pretty bad people. So it's really important to keep that circle around you that shows you that, you know, not everyone is bad.
Exactly.
So, but what I was thinking, my first idea of, like, a con would be the hours. So right. Have you ever had to work, like, go into the night shift?
Yeah. You know what? We, all police departments kind of do it a different way, but we have three shifts for San Diego Police Department. We have a morning shift, 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. We have an afternoon, which is 2 to midnight. And we have a graveyard shift, which is 9 at night till 7 in the morning. And we rotate. So every 4 months, everybody rotates. So it's fair. It's not like, oh, you're the new person. You're stuck on graveyards all year. But to be honest, Allie, like, I loved working graveyards because I think I'm more of a night person in general, but, and especially it's easier when you're younger, but to me, there was no greater feeling of responsibility than at 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning when you're driving around in your beat, you know, your neighborhood that you're supposed to be patrolling and everybody else is asleep, right? The only people awake are the Ubers, and nobody gets the newspaper anymore, but you know what I mean? Like, newspaper drivers used to get up really early. It's just you as a police officer, and you're there, everybody else is sleeping, and it's your responsibility to make sure that nobody's breaking into cars, breaking into houses, prowling around, doing things they're not supposed to do. And that's when I really felt that responsibility, what being a police officer is. You know, I'm here to protect the community. Everybody else is safe and asleep in bed. I'm the one who's awake, making sure that nothing goes wrong. And so that, to me, working graveyards, aside from the fact that the nighttime stuff is usually the fun, you know what I mean? Like,
more exciting.
People drink, people go out, you know, our violent crimes tend to happen probably in the evening hours, or, like I was talking about, people breaking into businesses or breaking into houses. Obviously, that happens usually under the cover of night. And so usually a graveyard shift was, there was a little bit more action on the front end of it. And then, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning, everybody should have already tapered off, gone to bed, sort of thing. And so you could have time to eat, do your paperwork, kind of chill out, and then go to those early morning alarm calls and early morning crashes before you call it a day.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. So if my mom asks, should I confirm to her that everything is worse after midnight?
I mean, pretty much. You should. I learned you should never drive in the fast lane after midnight because, or at least by 2 a.m, because the drunk drivers that are going to go the wrong direction on the freeway, they think the fast lane is the slow lane.
Oh my God.
Because they're going the wrong direction. Does that make sense?
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. So, life hack, everyone.
Stick to the second lane after midnight, folks.
Okay. So let's dive into something a little more positive. Sure. And I'm sure you have a lot of these answers, what I'm about to ask. What are the perks of being on the job?
The perks of being in a job. So, you know, the reason I joined was because I wanted a job that wasn't in an office. You know, not I wasn't a cubicle person. I didn't want to, you know, be stuck indoors. I wanted to be outside. So, you know, being an officer, especially one that's in patrol, you know, you get to work outdoors. You know, you have a full tank of gas that the city gives you and a badge and a gun. And they say whoever calls 911 first, you know, that's who you're supposed to go help that day.
Gas is a real big
problem. Gas is expensive in California. So, yeah. So, obviously, you know, we don't pay for our city gas. But, you know, just the fact that every day is different and you don't know what to expect that day, that was always the best thing to me. You know, there are days where I could answer 15 calls in a row, just one after the other, crash, domestic violence, noise complaint, you know, suicide, whatever it is, bam, 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 bam. And then there's days where you come out and the first call you get is, you know, shooting or a stabbing, and it turns into a homicide and you're stuck on that for the next 10 hours of your shift. So that spontaneity and that just not knowing what tomorrow's going to bring was a big appeal to me. And the fact that, again, as a patrol officer, once your day is done, your day is done. You go home, you relax. Tomorrow when you come in, there's no inbox. There's nothing waiting for you. It's just, again, whoever calls for help that day. So that was always a big plus to me. And then when you're working for a large agency like the San Diego Police Department, we have over 40 different uniformed assignments and over 30 different investigative assignments. So no matter what you want to do within law enforcement, whether that's I want to be on the SWAT team, I want to be on K-9, I want to work with kids, I want to be a community officer, or if you want to be a detective someday, everything from, you know, vice and narcotics up to homicide, domestic violence, you know, crimes against children, you know, human trafficking, you know, we have all these different positions. So even if you did a 30-year career with us and you changed jobs every single year, like, you'd still never hit all the things that you could do here. So that's the best part about it.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of different avenues to go to. I mean, that kind of sparked my interest because I don't think I could do police academy, like, to be completely honest.
Right.
But just yeah, you could do investigative reporting, would you say? You could do investigative reporting?
Yeah, detective, yeah.
But would you have to go through police academy to do that?
So it depends on what facet you want to get into. Like, as a detective, all detectives started as police officers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, right? And here's the thing. Like, in order to be a detective, you really need to know how to be a good street cop. I mean, you need to learn how to talk to people, whether that's victims, suspects, how to look for evidence. All the basic stuff you learn as a foundational patrol officer. A detective is really just the person who's going to take a case and do all the follow through. There are certain times where patrol officer, let's say somebody gets hit over the head with a bottle. I get there, I have the victim, I have the suspect. Well, I mean, case is closed, right? There's not a lot of investigating to it, but somebody has to do all the follow up paperwork that's going to go to the district attorney's office. Now, let's say somebody got hit over the head with a bottle, suspect is gone. Okay, well, I'm going to do as much as I can as the patrol officer that night to find the person, but if I don't, okay, then the case gets transferred to the detective who's going to do the rest of the follow-up and look for surveillance cameras and talk to witnesses, and, you know what I mean, do all the things that I couldn't do in the field. And so it's just important that they have that foundation of what being a police officer is like to be a detective someday. You know, we do have civilian staff that help our detectives. We do have an entire floor on our headquarters is the crime lab. So those are all civilians. So our crime lab folks are biologists and chemists and all the DNA folks that process all the evidence. So, you know, it is a team environment. It is a combination of sworn law enforcement and civilian staff that help us. But yeah, there's different ways to help.
So I'm going to backtrack a little bit about, you know, these crazy hours that I've heard and just the whole ambiguity of the day and like where it could lead you. How is it like to have a family? What is that like to juggle that with this job?
It can be difficult, I would imagine, especially with kids. I don't have kids right now, someday soon, but the shift work is hard, especially depending on what your spouse is doing. I mean, we have cops that marry other cops or firefighters or nurses. I mean, the whole first responder community seems small sometimes, but it really comes down to communication with your other half and working with schedules. I mean, I don't know a lot of civilian positions aside from the first responder community, hospitals and nurses, that sort of thing, where working graveyard shifts. So it really is just a balance. And depending on, do you have a support system here in town? Do you have your parents, you know, grandma and grandpa that can help watch the kids? Do you, are you paying for daycare? One of the things that our department is working on right now, actually, is a daycare program to subsidize daycare for officers, because we do have a lot of officers that are married to other first responders, other officers, and some of them are on call, right? So what happens if you're a detective on call in the middle of the night and you're the one with the kids and you get called out? What can you do? Do you have friends or family that can, you know, drop what they're doing in the middle of the night to watch your kids? And so, you know, our department is working with a company right now. It's not set in stone, so I won't mention the name, but they're working with a company right now to subsidize 24-hour daycare, basically, for our officers to watch their kids while they're working, or, again, if they're on call and they just kind of need a last-minute resource, that it's there for them.
Yeah, because I was going to say that this job seems so, like you said, that when you get off, you're off, but, I mean, are you really off? Like, what if you need someone to, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there are times, like I said, the average patrol officer, you know, when you're off, you're off. But like our detectives, like I mentioned, let's say a sex crimes detective, 24 hours a day, there are detectives that are on call. So once business hours are over, whether that's, you know, tonight or whether that's the weekend, there's a team of sex crimes detectives and a sergeant who, if there is an incident that warrants it, they get called out. Doesn't matter what time of day, doesn't matter the day of the week, they get called out to the scene to start the investigation right then and there, because it's such an important thing that we want to take care of. So yeah, there are times when you're on call. I happen to be part of the emergency negotiations team that's attached to our SWAT unit. And so I'm on call for this entire month of November. So I'm kind of tied to my phone, and I got to make sure that I look at all my texts, look at all the messages, and if I have to hear it at 2 o'clock in the morning, I have to hear that thing go off to make sure I can respond.
Right. So coming from a police officer's perspective, like, I know you have loved ones in the area and everything. Would you say you're more worried about them? Do you give them more tips, anything like that? Because I'm sure, like you've said, you have a different perspective on humanity.
No, you know, it's probably the opposite. I probably try not to tell them too much. You know, to be honest, it's, well, first of all, San Diego is the nation's safest large city. So just by crime statistic, you know, the FBI keeps all our crime statistics for the nation. And in terms of our large population cities, we are the safest statistically. And that's due to the work that our officers are doing out there. But, you know, from the average person, it's really just a matter of awareness of your surroundings, right? Who's around you? Where are you? You know, where's the exit? Kind of a thing. And I think most of my closest friends or family, I think, just get that vibe from me. Like, they know that I'm watching. When we go into a restaurant, this is probably something that the average person isn't aware of, but, you know, when a police officer goes to eat lunch, you know, if they're by themselves, they sit against the wall. Okay. They never have their back to the door, because I just need to see who walks in, right? I need to see who's walking up behind me. And so police officers will perch themselves against the wall. So, you know, when I'm out with my loved ones and we go into a restaurant, they automatically give me the back seat, even if I'm off, even if we could be at Disney. I was at Disneyland this weekend. You know, it doesn't matter where I'm at. That's just something that's ingrained in me. And they know that. You know, one of the other things that we teach our officers, though, is that you do have to have a conversation with your spouse and your kids, that if something crazy ever happens, that, you know, whatever the deal is that you work out with your friends and family, whether that's to run or do whatever, you have to have a conversation of working something out, a code word or whatever it is, so that they know that if something happens, that mom and dad are going to go to work and you have to run and go to the car, or, you know, call 911 and hide in the bathroom, or whatever it is. Especially right now, with, fortunately, we have a lot of these active shooters, right, that we keep hearing about. And
a lot in San Diego recently, I've heard on the news a little bit too.
We've had a few homicides recently, not the active shooter to the degree of that's happening around the nation right now. We've had them, obviously, in San Diego, but I never go to the movie theater, the mall, without my gun off duty. I always, generally speaking, always carry. And so, again, it's just a conversation you have to have with your loved ones that if we're at the mall and somebody starts shooting, you run, but I'm running towards the shooter. And they know that.
Yeah. And it's interesting also that you said, I mean, we kind of laughed about it, that you're at Disneyland and you're like, well, I have to be aware. And my first thought was that, you know what, that's not the craziest idea, because you see at a movie theater, in a Walmart, in a backyard party, at a temple, right. You literally have no idea.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, there used to be places that I think as a society, we all felt safe, whether that was a church, a synagogue, an amusement park, the Garlic Festival in Gilroy. Right. I mean, you know, there's such, you know, inane targets that you wouldn't think, like, why in the world would anybody? But unfortunately, we're just kind of at a place in time right now in our country where it's, you just don't know. Right. And so as a police officer, I feel the responsibility to always be prepared to be able to act and, you know,
use your knowledge for good.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So when you said you were part of SWAT, I had no idea about this, and I'm so intrigued. Tell
you everything. How much time do we have? No, I mean, we have, San Diego Police Department has one of the largest SWAT teams on the West Coast. We probably float an average of 80 folks on the team at any given time. Guys and girls, you know, we have a female SWAT officer right now. I think she's our fifth in our history. But our SWAT team is made up of two components, really. We have a full-time team made up of about a dozen or so officers. And then the other bulk of the team are collateral duty in patrol. So meaning they're working their patrol shifts, but they have all their gear in their trunk and they're ready to respond. So that way, San Diego PD has a small team of SWAT officers 24/7. We make sure that there's a SWAT team around the clock for the emergency type of stuff. Your active shooters, a hostage scenario, an officer that gets shot needs to be rescued. And then if it's a prolonged incident, like somebody barricades themselves in a house or something like that, then the rest of the team can come from home and we'll work it as we need to. But, you know, being on the SWAT team was a benefit in patrol because while you're on SWAT, you train every single month. So once a month, you get to, you know, not go to your regular station. You go to SWAT training and we practice our shooting. And then we practice, you know, every month would be something different. Again, whether it's building searches, active shooters, barricaded suspects, hostage rescue techniques. And so since I practiced those things so often as a SWAT member, now when I'm in the field just answering your everyday kind of calls, you know, a homeless person barricades themselves in the Starbucks bathroom and he's got a buck knife. I mean, like, what do you do? Other officers tend to look at the SWAT officers like, hey, I mean, you know what you're doing. Like, can you come up with a plan for this? And so it makes you a better patrol officer when you're on the SWAT team. And then, of course, feel that extra responsibility when a critical incident does happen.
Do you have an instance that you can tell us about a critical situation that you were a part of? Or a dangerous one?
Yeah,
I guess they're all dangerous.
they all have some component of that. I guess that's why we're there in the first place. You know, I did respond to the call when JD DeGuzman, Oscar DeGuzman, was shot and killed. I did respond out to that, and the shooter had fled at the time. But, you know, obviously we didn't know where they went at the time. And so I was part of the team that went into this, I'll just call it a riverbed. It wasn't the Mission Valley area, but it was down south.
Can you let us know and the listeners know what the story was?
Yeah. Oscar DeGuzman and his partner were patrolling the area down in the southeastern San Diego, and they saw a person that they wanted to talk to that was standing on the sidewalk. They were part of our gang suppression team at the time. And they made a U-turn, pulled up to the suspect. JD's partner had gotten out of the car already. JD was driving. Partner had gotten out of the car, and the person on the sidewalk advanced on his partner right away, shot him right away, shot him in the neck, and then basically kind of stuck the gun into the car and shot JD as he's still sitting in the driver's seat. trying to get out. And unfortunately, JD didn't survive his injuries. The partner who had been shot initially was down on the ground, but started to return fire, and the suspect ran off from there. So it wasn't even, there was no 911 call. It was just, oh, there's a guy, you know, let's go talk to him, just see what he's up to, see if he's from the neighborhood kind of thing.
Wow.
And things happen in a split second. And it was actually officers, you know, other officers that were in that area a few blocks away that heard the gunshots and knew that JD and his partner were in that area and went there immediately and started to help them. And so, but anyways, on my part, I you know, responded to that call. Obviously, they called out SWAT to help look for the suspect or suspects. At the time, we didn't know if it was one or two. And I just remember being part of a team that trudged through this very thick brush in this kind of riverbed area because, you know, we didn't know. And I had a police canine handler with me and a dog. And it's funny because normally the police dogs are pretty, you have to be really careful around the police dogs, right? Because they really only listen to their handler.
Yeah, and as they don't, a dog lover, it's the hardest thing.
Right? And they don't recognize a blue uniform from, you know, somebody in jeans and a t-shirt. And so you have to be really careful. But the dog that I happened to be with, thank goodness, was one that's pretty friendly around other officers. And he was in between my legs and going in front of me and weaving in and out. And it was just, you know, obviously it was a very long night for everybody because we had gotten the news that JD didn't make it. So those officers that were close to him that needed to go home went home, and the rest of us obviously stayed and were willing to stay as long as it took to find the person. And, you know, so we did a lot of searching in the area. Our detectives obviously came out, found different residences where the person might have been. And so, you know, eventually the person was caught and ultimately brought to justice. But, yeah.
Jeez, that must be, I can't even imagine. First of all, I'm so sorry that that happened. I know that you mentioned before that you become family with these people. Even if it is distant, it still hits home because also right. At the end of the day, it could have been you. You literally have no idea, and that's also a danger of the job.
Right.
But even if it wasn't you, it impacted you, you know, even if you don't realize it. Do they offer any psychological help or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, San Diego Police Department, we are one of the front runners when it comes to wellness. We have a whole wellness unit that's run by, say, two supervisors and a couple officers. And to be honest, other police departments travel from around the nation to model what we have in terms of our wellness unit. It's just very robust in terms of the resources that we have, whether it's, you know, like you talked about, mental health counseling, alcohol abuse, you know, gambling addiction, all sorts of things. The counseling is available not just to the officer, but to the officer's family and anybody living in their household. So even if you're having marriage trouble, even if you're having trouble with your kids, you know, the counseling is available. But of course, when there is a critical incident like an officer involved shooting or something like that to that magnitude, then yes, it is mandatory for us to go, you know, have what we call it a critical incident debrief, where everybody gets to, who was involved directly in the incident, sits down in a room and, you know, talks it out, and it's all confidential. And, you know, then if an officer is involved in a shooting, as if, you know, you're the one person that pulled the trigger, then yes, it is mandatory that you, you know, talk to the doctor and just make sure everything's okay.
That's good to hear, because also what my first thought is it's almost two worlds colliding. And I mean that as in one world being a completely masculine, you know, hide your emotions. That's something that is taught from a very young age. Sure. And then another world of let's talk it out. Let's focus on mental health. And it's nice to see that collision is happening. Do you see that other officers maybe are a little standoffish because they want to preserve their masculinity? Or do you see a very open group of people?
To be honest, times have changed. Since I've been on for 20 years, I've had the luxury of seeing what you're describing. Kind of maybe in the beginning of my career, nobody really talked about stuff. You just kind of compartmentalized everything and shoved it in the back, right? And I think over the last decade or so, there's been that switch in mentality. Like, no, listen, like we need to talk about this. Because statistically, more officers die from suicide across the country than they do from being killed, right? Which is terrible. It's an unfortunate thing when that happens, and it's happened to the San Diego Police Department. And, you know, you have to take a look at that and say, well, that's preventable, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, right. We should have been able to do something about that had the person, you know, had the resources or had what they need to get through whatever it was that was causing that depression or whatever was going on. And so there has been a shift for sure. And I think generationally too, you know, we have officers now who are in their 20s, you know, young 20s. And so they kind of, I think, grew up with more of an awareness of mental health. And I don't think it's so much of a stigma for folks to have a therapist, right? Or just have somebody that they need to talk to every once in a while, right? Mm-hmm. Just have a little check-in.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, as big of a stigma as it used to be. And so, you know, as a supervisor, if I see an officer struggling with anything, or, you know, they come to me, I'm kind of on our peer counseling team, if you will. So when folks do come to me and they just want to chat and I'm their ear, then it's my responsibility to make sure that I follow up and say, okay, well, you know, we chatted informally, but if you do want to talk to a professional, you know, here's the number, or here's how you can reach them, and, or here's, you know, our chaplain program or whatever it is that they need. And I feel like more and more people take advantage of it now than they ever did before.
Oh, good. Because, like, some of my first thoughts are also, is this like a Vietnam thing again, where, you know, so many people are coming back with PTSD and they just can't, there's a stigma and right. they just can't get those resources. And I don't know, it's comforting to hear, especially because these are the people, like, mental illness can drive so much of your decisions, I'm sure. If you have PTSD or something and you're in a situation that triggers that, it can lead to some irrational actions, I'm sure.
Sure.
So I want to go back to significant stories that you have possibly. Do you have any hostage situation stories or, you know, some intense action-packed stories?
Action-packed. My goodness.
Significant ones, or at least.
Significant ones. So, you know, I was trying to think. You know, it's funny that some of the most dangerous things that we do on this department is simply pulling somebody over. And because we kind of mentioned that before, that you don't know who the person is that you're pulling over or why they're not stopping. And so when I was early in my career, I pulled somebody over in Tierra Santa. It was the middle of the night. I was by myself. And the person was just kind of weaving over the lines, driving up the road. So in my mind, okay, I mean, the guy's just drunk, like, whatever. I'll stop him, get my DUI, we'll move on with the life. And I stopped the car. There was a guy that was driving, and I looked over in the passenger seat, and there was a female, and she was crying. I was like, oh, okay, well, something else is going on. So I tried to chit-chat, do the general thing. Hey, this is why I stopped you, license, registration, all that stuff. And but I wanted to separate them to make sure everything was okay with the female. And so I had the male come out, and I was by myself, so I had him sit down on the curb for a sec and try to distract him while I waited for another officer to come. But I was kind of in the outskirts of Tierra Santa. And I was like, okay, hang on, guy, let me just make sure everything's okay with her. And when I went back to the car, he got up and tried to confront me, and he wasn't listening anymore. And anyways, we ended up getting into this tussle on the ground. We rolled around for a little bit, and he got up and started running. And I started to run after him. And then when I looked back, the female was gone now. And I'm like, where did this girl go? Like, I was trying to help you. So I lost. I mean, I had to, he ran off, and, you know, in my mind, I had to balance, like, okay, let me go back and check on her. You know, my car is still running. Like, okay, I have his driver's license. Like, I'll figure out who he is. Well, it turns out that he was on parole. He was wanted. He had just beat her up, which is why she was crying. And he had a sawed-off shotgun in his car.
Oh, my God.
And that's what I said in my head. Like, when I pulled that out from under the seat, I was like, oh, my goodness, this could have gone so many different ways. And then we ended up finding her. She was hiding in somebody's backyard a couple houses down because she was afraid to talk to us, you know, because she was afraid of him, kind of a thing. And we ended up catching him maybe about 10 hours later, hiding in the neighborhood. My next shift found him walking down the street and got him into custody. But there are so many things like that where we roll into a situation. We just don't know what's going to happen, when it's going to happen. And I've, over 20 years, trust me, I've been to shootings and stabbings, and I've responded to hostage situations. But to be honest, it's the little things, you know, the traffic stops, the domestic violence call that you're like, okay, another domestic violence call. You know what I mean? Those are the types of situations that can change drastically. Our last officers that were shot in San Diego, actually just down the street off of Rolando, in the Rolando area, were responding to a call of a guy who was making noise in his apartment. And the neighbors called and said he was yelling and breaking things, and the officers went, and they had dealt with this person before, right, with no issues before. So they thought, yeah, it's just him again, kind of making noise, you know, running amok. They didn't hear anything. You know, when they knocked, he was all quiet. They didn't hear anything, but unfortunately, they smelled smoke coming from the apartment now. So they're like, okay, well, did he light something on fire in there? Is he cooking? And it's like turning bad.
Popcorn,
but something's on the stove, right? But, you know, you're in an apartment building, and like, we got to make sure that nothing's going to burn down. And they called the fire department. They came out. They're like, yeah, I think we need to go inside and make sure that they're not passed out or they're not starting a fire in there. And can see actually on Instagram, they play the first part of the clip where the firefighter breaks the door open, and then the police officers kind of poke their head and say, hey, San Diego Police Department, is everybody okay? And immediately the gunshots come out from a rifle at the officers, and one officer gets hit immediately, goes down. His partner has to grab him, start trying to drag him out. They're in this long hallway, which we call the fatal funnel, because you're in a long hallway and there's no place to go. Like, you're stuck. There's no left or right or protection
just
or anything.
Forward or backwards.
Forward or backwards. And they had to go backwards. And unfortunately, they came to the end of the hallway, which was a window pane, and they were on the second floor. And they ended up having to break out one of the window panes. Somebody from outside was able to throw up a shield to them through the window. And almost at the same time that they placed the shield down, he came out of his door and started shooting down the hallway again. And that's when the other officer got shot, because it went through the shield. I mean, luckily it stopped it enough or diffused it enough where it wasn't a fatal hit, but he got shot through the lower jaw area.
Have you ever been shot at or shot yourself?
No, where's the wood at?
Yeah, right here.
Right here, all over. No, thank goodness. I mean, like I said, I've been on calls where other officers have fired their firearms. I've been on calls where suspects have fired, but I've never been the direct target, I would say, of being shot at or stabbed or feloniously assaulted, which, you know, in 18 years of being out in the field is actually a lucky thing. But to be honest, most officers, and I don't know the exact percentage, but I'll just say, you know, at least 95-98% of the police officers out there go their entire career without pulling the trigger. You know, and I want people to know that, because what you see on TV and the media and social media, all that stuff, like, not that it's not reality, but there's so much of the negative stuff that is, you know, focused on, that the reality is that most police officers go their entire career and then they never pull the trigger and they never have to. It's just, we get bombarded, I think, with a lot of things that it never used to be like that. You know what I mean? Like, being a police officer in San Diego, I only really have control of my actions and what I'm doing. And now as a supervisor, I have control of my officers, but I don't have control about what a police officer in Kansas City does, right? But if there's an incident in Kansas City where somebody gets shot and it looks controversial, sometimes I have to hear about that here in San Diego. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where people treat me differently because they saw that. And I'm like, that wasn't even here, like, wasn't me, it wasn't here. And the way we do business here in San Diego is, I'm sure, a lot different than the way they do business in another city. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
so
there's a lot of I've done some research specifically in Texas mm-hmm. with the whole Amber Geiger, the whole Amber Geiger thing that happened. I don't know if you heard about that. So she was an off-duty officer, and she went into
the wrong apartment.
Wrong apartment, and just for the listeners' sake, if they don't know what happened, sure. So Amber Geiger was off-duty. She went into the wrong apartment. I think it was the third floor. She meant to go on the fourth or whatever, vice versa. And she shot an unarmed African-American and killed him, and now she got sentenced to jail. But, I mean, that opens up a whole other conversation about police brutality and how it's affected you. I know you said that, you know, people start treating you differently, but, it, like, can you go on about that?
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned before, like, I personally feel like I can only control myself, right, and my actions and how I treat people. And as a supervisor, again, kind of make sure my officers are doing the right thing. But where I do feel an obligation is if somebody does feel a certain way about the police negatively, that I feel like I have an obligation to talk to them, right? And ask them why. And maybe just, you know, spark an idea that not all cops are bad people, right? We're not all the same. We're not trained the same. We don't do the same things. And that the majority, the overwhelming majority of police officers are out there doing the right thing, right? You're always going to have a bad apple somewhere, right? Law enforcement, Catholic Church, the dentist office, whatever it is, right? You're never going to have perfect people because we recruit from the human race. But most of the officers that are out there are good, hardworking people that are trying to do the right thing. But I've been in situations where I remember I was eating at Five Guys, right? And it was the Five Guys in UTC. So, you know, kind of a nicer-ish area. And I'm literally have the burger in my hand, about to put it up in my mouth. And an older black gentleman walks past me and says, "Hands up, don't shoot," and he keeps walking. And I just remember thinking, like, first of all, I was like, I'm just eating my lunch. is now the time to get deep in conversation? But, he literally did just walk off and didn't stop and whatever. But I really wish I would have just said, well, hold up a minute. Like, let's talk about that. You know what I mean? Like, and since that happened to me that one time, I have made it a point, because, you know, every once in a while somebody will say, "Hey, you're just arresting me because I'm this, right? I look this way, I talk this way, whatever." And I really do make the extra effort to say, "Okay, listen, I know it might appear that way to you, but, you know, this is why we're here, and it randomly come up on you, like somebody called me here, right? So and this is why you're going to jail, or this is why I'm talking to you. It's not because I saw the color of your skin and I just decided." You know what I mean? I mean, it's been this one time I was responding to a robbery call. I can't remember. It was like at a phone, like a Cricket Wireless type of store. And, you know, we got a description of the car that was leaving the scene, and it was darker. And I remember using my big floodlights, you know what I mean, those big flashlight things, to look at the cars that were going the other direction, because obviously I'm looking for the person. And now I'm at the store, I'm investigating the crime, and a woman drives up and she's like, "You are flashing your lights at me. I want to know, what's your problem? You know, why are you looking at me? You know, it's just because I'm this, that, and the other." And I'm like, "Ma'am, like, the store just got robbed, and they were driving a whatever, blue Toyota Corolla. So I'm looking for a blue Toyota Corolla. You had a blue car. I'm making sure, and I'm looking at you as a driver. Yes, I was looking at you. Yes, I shine my flashlight in your face, but this is why." And then she's like, "Oh, okay. All right.
It wasn't me. I'm good.
Bye." You know what I mean? And so, you know, a lot of times it just takes that extra effort
to say,
"This is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it." Now, that's a luxury, right? It's not, police officers don't always have the time to go into explanation, right? And there's been times where I'm literally like pointing my gun at somebody and telling them to drop this and do that. And they'll be like, it wasn't me. I didn't do it. You know what I mean? And when an officer is engaging you with their gun pointed at you, that's not the time, right, for the explanation. Like, the explanation can come after the fact. But what folks need to realize that, you know, as a police officer, our responsibility is to make sure that everything is safe first. Safety to us usually means folks are detained, whether that means they're in handcuffs, pat you down. Okay, nobody has weapons. Everybody's good. Okay, cool. Now let's talk. Okay, now what happened? Tell me what's going on. But when there's a gun pointed at you and we're just giving you commands, people would just kind of stop and listen to those commands for a sec. Doesn't matter if you're not the person. I don't know that, right? At the time, I don't know that until I verify personally that you're not the person with the gun or whatever the situation is. That's not the time to argue. So if we have the luxury of time, explanations, boom, you're going to get them. But in the heat of the moment, listen to the officer's commands, please.
Yeah, I mean, I would honestly, I do believe we have racial injustice and we do have problems. Like, I can't deny that. Sure. But it sounds like it's a top-down solution. So, like, criminal justice reform and you know, trainings from higher ups, it needs to trickle down and then we can work on the problem. And it sounds like that one-on-one connection is needed to solve it, because once you have a good experience with someone, then what's to say it's all bad, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, like San Diego Police Department, we do really good with our, you know, community policing models. The chief's office has different community liaisons for different community groups, whether that's a racial community group. I happen to be in charge of the disabled community group. So these community groups are made up of leaders from that particular community, whether it's race, religion, or ability, disability. And twice a year, they get to sit down with the chief of police, like number one chief, and the assistant chief in charge of neighborhood policing. And they get to voice any concerns. Hey, this is what we're hearing. This is what's going on in our neighborhood. This is what we would like for training for our officers or something like that. And, you know, that's twice a year. And then throughout the year, they have a direct contact person, like for the disabled group. Like, anybody from that community can contact me directly if they have an issue with an officer or they had an incident and they're like, I'm not sure if the officer did the right thing. Like, can I just run this by you? Or, hey, like, this happened. Can we make sure the officers know that, I don't know, like, this is what we would like to happen. Like, for example, I had some officers that arrested a blind person and their dog ended up going to the animal shelter. So that's not the first step in terms of what we normally would do with the dog, right? We try to find a friend or family member that the person going to jail wants their dog to go to, or the dog can go back to their school that they came from originally. And then if we can't find any of those things, then we'll do the animal shelter. But, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of nuances to police work, right? And we have to be jacks of all trades. So there are times where legitimately an officer maybe didn't do the right thing, but it wasn't an intentional thing. It was just a mistake of, oh, well, I've never dealt with this situation. And I kind of did something that was common sense per se. So part of it could be training. Part of it could be education. But SDPD has these community groups for that reason. It's training for the community, because I can come talk to these my community group and say, hey, if you ever get pulled over by a police officer, this is what we would like, right, from the police. This is what we expect. I do that quite often with my deaf and hard of hearing community, right, because there's going to be a language barrier. Okay, this is why we want to see your hands, and, you know, I have to explain those things. And so part of it is an educational piece for the community. And then part of that is, okay, this is what the community would like from us. This is what they would like in terms of training or how we would like the officers to respond or treat us in certain situations.
So I want to dive into one more topic, just because I know your time is very sensitive, but I feel like this is important. So I'm a woman, and I know that there's a lot of domestic violence cases and stuff like that. You just want to talk about that really quickly, like tips that we I guess obviously men can be victims of domestic violence too. And sure. Just in general, like how to stay safe and if you've ever been so attached to a case, anything like that.
It's crazy because you heard about the shooting a couple days ago, the homicide.
The family. Barbecue, just to let our listeners know, I believe.
Oh, no, not even that one.
Oh, really? I mean,
we have a domestic violence homicide that just happened where it looks like, I mean, nothing's been confirmed officially, but it looks like that the male went back to his ex's place and unfortunately killed her and killed the children and then killed himself. And so, you know, over the years, I mean, you know, the police department understands how volatile domestic violence situations can be. And trust me, we respond to domestic violence calls every single day, all day, every day, no matter what division you're working, there's probably going to be a domestic violence call or a few. And so where it's really important is the follow through with that, with the victims. You know, we have advocates that can come out and talk to the victims. We have a, what we call the Family Justice Center downtown, where it's a one-stop shop. So it's one building where our domestic violence detectives work there. The city attorney, district attorney's office that will prosecute the cases works there. And all the, it's kind of the resource center for the victims, all in the same building, right? So our domestic violence detectives aren't even at headquarters. They're at the Family Justice Center. So it's meant to be this one-stop shop of resources where somebody can go if they are the victim of a crime and, okay, talk to the officers or talk to the detectives and then go to the next office and talk to the attorney that's going to prosecute and et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, those are set in place because we know that, unfortunately, there are these cases like the one that happened the other day where it does turn violent. And you just don't know, you know, again, when that's going to happen. I've personally had cases where I arrested somebody for domestic violence at the beginning of my shift and took him to jail, did everything I was supposed to do, wrote the report, took him to jail, did the whole thing. And before I left my shift, he was already out. He had bailed out and was now breaking into the house again. And I arrested him a second time.
Oh, my like, God. That's nice just, to it see was you again.
Crazy, right? You know, at least I know what you look like and I know who to look for.
Yeah.
No, but, I mean, it's just we know that with domestic violence, I mean, it's an emotional thing, right? It's a relationship. And folks aren't, you know, willing to give that up very quickly. And I understand that. Like, I can't imagine, you know, being in a situation like that. But there are times where enough is enough, right? And when the police say no and the judge says no and you have a restraining order, you know what I mean? But when folks are persistent, that's when I think victims really have to pay attention to what's going on and the different warning signs, because that's the last thing I want to do is see the same person get victimized over and over and over again. You know what I mean? But the resources definitely are there for the folks. I'm sure it's not easy, right, to navigate everything. I mean, I understand that. But the resources are there for the folks that want and need the help. And, you know, there's good people out there that are, you know, advocates and all that stuff that, just like the officers, they're there because they want to help. You know, they're there because they want to get people out of the situation. So
that just must be so hard. I mean, because, you know, I would assume most of the victims are women. So to have a woman in your life, like whether that be a spouse, a mom, a sister, a child, I can't imagine that would be really emotional to go to those calls. And, you know, I would picture whoever to right. be in that position. I can't imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just like you said, an awareness piece too, that maybe it's not you, but maybe it is your best friend. Maybe it's your sister or whoever that you see in that kind of relationship that just doesn't seem healthy. And, you know, there are also ways for people to kind of anonymously report things, right? Or if they, you know, first of all, if anything ever is violent happening, please, you know, call 911 right away. It doesn't matter. But even we get a lot of calls that are called check the welfares, right? So folks will say, hey, this is what I think is going on. I'm not totally sure, you know, if this is going on, but can you please check on so-and-so? Can you please go check their welfare? And so we have those calls quite a bit where we'll go out, and whether it's we're checking on the kids, we're checking on the person, we'll just say, hey, somebody called. They wanted to be anonymous, but we want to make sure that everything's okay here. And, you know, we'll always talk to a couple separately, right, so that there's no, like, nobody's standing over the other person making sure they say the right things, right? You know what I mean?
policing them.
No, exactly. Yeah, sorry. But yeah, so we'll always talk to parties separately, depending on the ages of the kids, you know what I mean? We might talk to the kids, we might not, depends on them. But no, but we want to make sure that everybody is safe and, you know, in a healthy relationship. I mean, that's what we all deserve at some point.
Okay, well, I know, again, that your time is sensitive, so I don't want to belabor everything. I seriously could talk here for hours just because I'm a chatty Kathy and I want to know everything in the world. But I want to give you a chance to talk now. I know you're in the recruiting department. Do you want to give a shout-out to that and, like, how to get involved, if just anything? Yeah,
for sure. So, like I said, I mean, this job is awesome. There's so many pathways you can go in the law enforcement career, and San Diego PD offers a lot of that. And we hire continuously, number one. There's four police academies that we put on a year, and we have 50 seats in every academy that are guaranteed to us, and we can go above that if we have the qualified bodies. So we're constantly hiring. JoinSDPDNow.com is our main recruiting website, and JoinSDPDNow is our Instagram as well, where you can find a lot of information. But the website gives you the basic info, and you would go to the website to sign up for the written test. It's an 8-step process, right? Written test, obstacle course, and then you enter backgrounds. A couple interviews, polygraph, psych, medical, evals, that sort of thing. And right now we're averaging about 4 months to get people a conditional job offer. So 4 months start to finish. And it is a competitive process, but we need good people. You know what I mean? Like, to hire 200 a year is a lofty, a lofty task.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, and I mean, like, in an environment where right now, I feel like cops are, you know, moving towards the positive side of things culturally. But, you know, we're always on this pendulum of, all right, cops are the bad guys. And then all of a sudden, okay, now we're the good guys again. You know what I mean?
New day, new news.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Firemen, they always have it so easy. Everybody loves firemen, man. But no, but, you know, we're always hiring. And you can always contact, you know, our office for more information, or hit us up on Instagram. You can just direct message us, whatever it is.
Do you want to say that Instagram?
Yeah, join SDPD now. And that's our recruiting Instagram. Department has one as well that you can follow. But in terms of questions for us, you know, we have obstacle course practice sessions twice a week, that you can find the address and the info on the website. And we're always looking for good people. Don't let anything that you did in the past, you know, dissuade you. None of us were perfect, right? When we were kids, I did dumb things when I was a kid. And, you know, we're not looking for perfect people. We're just looking for folks that, you know, want to be, you know, honest, hardworking police officers. And, you know, we're always looking for diversity. We're always looking for females. We want our police department to reflect the community that we serve. You know what I mean? And San Diego is a melting pot. You know,
very diverse.
I happen to be a native, but a lot of people aren't, right? A lot of people, are you from?
No, Arizona.
Exactly.
5 hours away.
Only 5 hours away. You know, it's a military town too, so we have a lot of military folks that transition. But we get a mix. We get a mix of military folks. We get a mix of college students. And I will say, actually, San Diego State is our biggest feeder college, because you guys have such a large...
You have ROTC,
yeah, right? And you have a large criminal justice program.
Yeah.
And so we get together with your CJ clubs, and they run the PAC course, you know, the obstacle course. You know, they have their own private days on the obstacle course, and we come to different professors' classes and talk to the classes. And, hey, if you're graduating this semester, you know what I mean, you should start lining yourself with a career, because... Really, it's one of the only jobs where within the first 3 years or so, you're going to be making over $100,000.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? And that's...
Maybe I will join.
I mean, you know what? You might as well try out. I mean, even... It's funny, because even with a high school diploma, obviously, like, if you have your degree, you are going to get paid more. And it will be an advantage down the road for promotions and that sort of thing. It makes you a little bit more competitive. But a lot of our... You know, some of our candidates don't have college education. So what do they have? Well... They have the military? Okay, cool. Or what life experience do you have? Do you bring to the table that would make you a good, well-rounded person? So it's not always about the formal education. Like I said, it helps, and it helps you get paid a little bit more. But we look at the person as an overall. You know,
you don't need good education to be a good person.
No, right? Because you should just be a good, honest human being, right? We should all be nice to each other.
Exactly.
Like Ellen says, just be nice.
But then you wouldn't have a job. So
I
need that.
Know. Well, there's always going to be the seedier element out there. And that's the thing. It's job security,
yeah.
Right? You go into the tech industry, you don't know if you're going to have a job next year or, you know, all the .coms, that whole thing. But
so I'm looking at law because I always know there's going to be some shady people.
There you go. But so we'll always need first responders. We always need people who are willing to step up and say, this is not right. And I'm going to be the one to take care of business. So
amazing. So I'm going to end this on the lightest note possible. Do you like donuts?
Of course I like donuts. They're delicious. You probably won't catch me in uniform eating them just nobody so snaps no the pictures.
Yeah,
but,
I'm just going to say.
of course I do. But I also exercise so that I can eat whatever the heck I want.
Me
so.
Too. It's all about balance in
exactly.
life.
Exactly. Everything in moderation.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. If you have any last words, like final words, go ahead and say them now. But other than that, I had a really good time. Thank you again for coming on.
I appreciate the opportunity not only to, like I said, be a recruiter for the police department because that's my job, but to, again, spark the conversation that we're all good people out here. We're mostly, 99% of us are good people out here. We're trying to do the right thing. And you know, if you have any questions at all about what's going on in the world or what it's like to be a cop, you know, stop a police officer and talk to them and just say, hey, what's going on? Or, hey, I saw this. Is that real? You know what I mean? Is that really what it's like out there?
You might regret telling me that. Well, you know what I mean? Every single person.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the San Diego State officers here. They're going to get a lot of questions. So.
For real.
Anyways, thank you. I appreciate it.
Of course. All right. Well, thank you all for tuning in. Again, this is the Golden Hour with your host, Allie Goldberg. And tune in again soon. Again, don't know what we're doing in a couple weeks, but it will be amazing, like always. Thanks, everyone. Bye.